Welcome back then, you're listening to The Asylum on 107.3 Stafford FM. It's me, Gunnar, in the chair of Destiny, joined, as always, by my able compatriots. D-Dog, how's it going, fella?
Excellent, sir. Most excellent.
Good, and we have most excellent. Yeah. I like it. And we've got a lovely guest on the line as well tonight, Andrew Johnson, of course, talking to us about some of the mysteries, some of the research surrounding 9/11, of course. Before we get into that, buddy, I've got to tell you where I'm going tomorrow.
Where are you off?
I'm going tomorrow to Paraforce UK in Nottingham.
Is that some kind of, like, jump out of planes?
No, they're not like a military organisation, you know, although they probably operate like one. I'm actually going to a paranormal conference over at the Justice of Galleries, I think it is. What's that called? I can't remember. Brain's gone blank. Over in Nottingham, really looking forward to that. Seeing former Asylum guests, of course, Malcolm Robinson, Ben Emlyn Jones. They'll be there tomorrow to talk in Richard Felix. It's going to be really fascinating and interesting. Looking forward to that. We've got the Origins Conference as well coming up in November. You can head over to www.megalithomania.co.uk for tickets for the Origins Conference. Coming back to Paraforce, I should say, you can buy tickets on the door. All of the pre-sale tickets are sold out, but you can still get in on the door for a fiver tomorrow. It starts at 10 o'clock, of course. Head over to paraforceuk.com to find out a bit more about that. Now, we should have on the line Andrew Johnson. Good evening, Andrew.
Good evening, Ian.
Can you hear me, Andrew?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Let's see if he's there. You can hear me, Andrew?
Can you hear me?
Yeah,
I can hear you.
Pete, I think I pressed the button by accident. No. With my elbow. Hey, Andrew, how are you, fella?
I'm all right, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, we're all right, buddy. Hey, Andrew, you live in Derby, don't you?
I do, yes. Just outside Derby, actually, yeah. So, not ever so far away from where you're going tomorrow.
Ah, very nice. Are you doing alright?
I'm getting some break.
Are you going
here,
tomorrow,
Sam,
Andrew?
You cut out there for about 2 seconds.
Oh, that probably made it even worse. are you going to the Paraforce conference tomorrow?
I only found out about it today, so I don't have any plans to go over there at the minute.
Ah, right, okay. It is actually the fiver to get in. I'll just run that one again.
Yeah.
Hey, Andrew, what got you interested in this sort of stuff? What got you interested in researching, in the paranormal, UFOs, conspiracy theories?
Yeah, well, I tried to stay away from conspiracy theories, but I became interested in this sort of field, intensively, I suppose you'd say, in 2003. And right. I found out about the Disclosure Project, Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project. That's kind of what kicked me into high gear, so to speak. And but I had a UFO sighting when I was about 10 years old. I was with a friend, and then I had another one in 1990, and then I've had a couple more since then, since I became more interested. So it was really this Disclosure Project, and I realised that there was stuff going on which wasn't being properly, covered. And so I started to investigate more and more. I'd got a broadband connection by then, and so that's what really set me going.
Interesting. I mean, what's your website as well, Andrew? Is this www.checktheevidence.com, is it?
That's right, yeah. So that was kind of... I started that really as a sort of archive because I was finding all kinds of stuff, and I wanted to sort of put that together as a reference site, really. And then I sort of revamped that with the help of somebody else in about 2007, and it's sort of been in the same sort of format since about 2007 or so. Maybe, yeah, about 2007 is when I revamped it, and I've just been adding to it ever since.
What kind of things can we find on there, then?
Well, there's basically about 7 or 8 categories on there. Most stuff that I've got on there is about 9/11, really. I think there's about, there's over 100 articles that have done about 9/11, some other people have done as well. It's not all my own work. There's stuff about the energy cover-up. There's a little bit of disclosure-type material. There's some stuff on the health scams and cover-ups. I've got a section on Mars and the solar system, a section on the moon hoax, just a couple of other categories, really, anti-gravity, a little bit on crop circles, there's only one or two things on that. And really, the thing is that these things are all interconnected, and the connections between Absolutely. Some of these things, you know, are clearer than most people think, I think.
I think there's much more scientific evidence and explanations for a lot of this stuff as well. I think that, you know, we talk about anti-gravity there. There's a good chance that, you know, perhaps our governments have this kind of craft, isn't there, and this kind of stuff as well.
Well, I personally have no doubt that somebody knows how gravity works. And, of course, in mainstream science, although they'll talk about the law of gravity and, you know, the various equations that you can use to calculate the motion of objects and this sort of thing, the mainstream will claim that they don't really know how gravity works, you know, and they're not sure whether it arises out of a quantum field or what, you know. But there's tenuous talk of a link between sort of gravity and other forces, like the electromagnetic forces and this sort of thing. But it's all kind of wishy-washy and couched in terms which are plausibly deniable. And there isn't much experimental research to do with what gravity might be. Not really much what I would call valid experimental research in mainstream science. They did build this giant sort of gravity wave detector, which is about 4 kilometres long or something. And there was some hoo-ha about that recently as well. But I have no doubt, partly to because of what happened on 9/11, that somebody in the black world knows exactly how gravity works, and they know how it works to a point where they're able to engineer effects at will, basically. You know, that was one of the things that I mentioned just briefly on Facebook, is that there is this evidence which links 9/11 to these sorts of effects.
That's curious, because the American government is certainly set to have Tesla's work in his Colorado Springs experiments, where he actually investigated, and certainly sounds like he discovered the human resonance way, way, way before human did, so the resonance of the planet. But also considering magnetism, gravity, electricity, all encompassing as one entity and not subdividing it into the way we do, and in doing so would actually offer a great deal more potential, certainly regarding the truth of the universe.
Yeah, I mean, I just didn't catch the very beginning of that, but I think there is these links have been talked about, you know, by certain scientists for quite a few decades. And this thing called the Schumann resonance that you mentioned, that's not really what I'd call it's not really talked about in mainstream science, to my understanding. It's mentioned in a few of the sort of alternative science areas. But it's not something you could probably go to university and do a PhD thesis on, as far as I'm aware. I could be wrong about that, but it's something that the Schumann resonance is something I've only come across, you know, in my research on the internet. It's not something I was ever taught about when I did physics at university, which I did for 3 years.
I did engineering myself, and I must admit I've learnt a great deal more since leaving university than I did while I was there, that's for sure.
Tesla being one of those people, Pete, of course.
Yeah, as an engineer, you think you learn a great deal about the man who was passed off as inventing AC and has his name given to the SI unit for magnetic field strength.
And he did way more than that, of course.
He certainly did.
Andrew, then, just coming to 9/11, you've got some really kind of interesting research in conjunction with Judy Wood, I think it is, as well. What are your thoughts? What would you like to see people think, let's say, about, you know, 9/11? Are there still questions out there that need to be answered?
Well, of course, there are many, many questions. But what I would like people to do is study the research that you mentioned there, Dr. Judy Wood's research primarily. And, you know, we just sort of put that in a context, really, because, you know, I don't know who's listening, but people might be quite new to this sort of area. You know, obviously we have the official story of 9/11, which is that 19 hijackers made a coordinated hijacking, you know, and they took three planes, took control of three planes, and, you know, and then there was a fourth one as well, and they crashed one into the Pentagon, they crashed one in Shanksville into the ground, and they crashed two into the World Trade Center towers in New York City. And the story then goes that these plane crashes in New York City started these fires in the towers, and then the fires, you know, weakened the steel, and the steel bent, and the towers fell down. You know, they collapsed. This word collapse was then used ad infinitum. And that, of course, was the start of the big war on terror, because these, you know, were Muslim fundamentalists, so they decided to go and invade Muslim countries. And that was the story that I believed myself until probably sort of mid to late 2003, early 2004 sort of time frame, which was when I was looking at all this other stuff. And then I heard this story about there being bombs in the building, in the World Trade Center particularly, and I saw a film which talked about this idea that somebody had put bombs in the building, and that they must have done that because these towers came down at free fall speed. And I looked at this video and I did this calculation myself, which is a simple calculation, and I thought, oh my God, you know, that, yeah, they did. That means that the official story cannot be true, and scientifically you can prove that it cannot be true. So I thought, this is a cinch. We can easily prove scientifically that this story is untrue. So, you know, let's try and do this. Let's move forward with this. And that was my baptism, really, into the so-called 9/11 truth movement in 2004. And then in 2005, we'd set up this UK forum about 9/11 truth. And I helped set that up. That was later taken control of by somebody called Tony Gosling, who, as far as I understand, is on the payroll of, as in HM payroll, to keep these things covered up. But this bombs in the building story, you know, we had some postings on the Facebook posting that you made earlier tonight, a couple of hours ago, people saying, oh, yeah, it was controlled demolition. Well, how do these people know that? You know, how do these people that posted those things know that? Because they've watched a YouTube video. Well, indeed, that's what I did. That, you know, I was doing that a few years ago, but then I realized that story was also untrue. And I was shown, primarily by Dr. Judy Wood, that the buildings didn't collapse. They actually turned to dust, and they turned to dust before they hit the ground. And you can see this in the actual videos. You can also come to know this from studying the seismic evidence. And this is where you get, you know, seismic, obviously, reading is when there's an earthquake and the ground shakes. And that can happen when there's an earthquake, or it can happen when there's a big explosion at a quarry or, you know, a volcano or something. And this is measurable. And they have these seismometers going all the time, you know, to measure earthquakes, as you probably know. So this is something, again, that's scientifically measurable. And when Dr. Wood went and got the seismic data for the destruction of the towers, primarily 1, 2 and 7, the readings weren't commensurate with a 110-storey building hitting the ground. In fact, the readings were very unusual, and they show that the ground actually reacted to the building disappearing. So it was the opposite of a collapse. It was actually as if the buildings had been lifted off the ground. That's what the seismic readings actually showed. And so the point of that is that if what do bombs do? Bombs explode. What would they do to a building? Well, essentially they'd cut parts of the building up, you know, some main girders or whatever argument they want to use. But then those chunks of building would fall to the ground. So the amount of building that falls to the ground would be the same as what it was constructed, you know, when it was constructed. So if the building was a million tons in weight, then a million tons of debris or thereabouts would hit the ground. But the seismic readings didn't show that. So that right there completely disproves both the official story of 9/11 and the fake story of the destruction of the World Trade Center, which was started quite soon after the event. Certainly the bombs in the building story was pretty well established by 2003-2004. So you then have to, once you've established that, as Dr. Wood had established that fairly early on, you have to look for another explanation. You know, it wasn't planes crashes that caused it, because again, if planes crashed, the buildings would have sort of burned and then fallen to the ground, so you would have all that material coming down, and it didn't. And bombs would essentially just cut the building into chunks, the material would come to the ground, and you'd get the seismic signature and so forth. Didn't happen. So you have to go and work out from other evidence what actually happened.
So, Andrew, then, what do you think, what do you and Judy Wood think actually happened on 9/11?
Well, what actually happened was a number of things. Like I say, the buildings didn't hit the ground in solid form. And so, as Dr. Wood says, they went away. And then you begin to look for how they went away, what sort of effects were seen. And you may have heard, some listeners may have heard, for example, of these cars. There were some police cars, for example, that were completely, it looked like they'd been burned in a fire. But this was a very unusual type of fire because...
Strange patterns, wasn't it, I think?
Yeah, that's right. There was partly that. And, in fact, even the plastic lights, you know, the polycarbonate lights on the top, some of the cars, they were intact, but the rest of the car was burned out. So if you study these pictures for long enough, if you just glance at them for 5 seconds, it just looks like a regular car fire, as if... you know, some material has come down from the burning of the World Trade Center and you know, landed on the cars and set them on fire. But if you study it in more detail, you can see, for example, that some of these cars, certainly in a particular parking lot which has since been built on, we have a picture of them just before the tower was destroyed and the dust cloud came rolling down the street, and just afterwards. And we can see that some of these cars are perfectly fine after the dust cloud has rolled past, but the rest of them are completely toasted. They're, as in history, they're destroyed. And so what this points to, this is one of the things that points to some type of energy being involved. And this, as it turns out, you look at this dust cloud and how it behaves and what effects it had on the surroundings, and it appears that it had some type of energy in it. And effects that were seen in the dust, you know, such as it continued to degrade after it had settled on the ground. Because, in other words, it settled on the ground and then some of it started to rise up into the air again. And this can be observed in sort of sequences of photographs which, you know, were taken by the various photographers that were there. So this, again, seems to be some type of energy effect. And the way that the buildings actually turn to powder, again, if you look at a mechanism for doing that, how can that happen? Well, let's say it was a nuclear device, a nuclear bomb going off. Some people are probably saying, oh, yeah, well, Andrew's not mentioned nuclear devices. Well, what do nuclear devices do? Well, they explode. They create a lot of light. They create a lot of noise. They create a lot of heat. But as you and I well know from looking at the footage of 9/11, there wasn't an awful lot of noise, there wasn't a brilliant explosion, and people weren't burned to death. We saw people that were covered in dust. 14 people walked out of Stairwell B, these firefighters that were there. They'd had 100 stories of building land on top of them, yet they looked out and they saw sunlight, and they survived and they walked out unharmed. How is that possible? If a nuclear bomb went off, they would have been irradiated and fried to death. And the whole of New York would have seen a brilliant flash. And even if you try... Sorry.
No, I was going to say, I mean, just quickly, we'll just hold you there, actually, Andrew, and we'll drop out to a break, and we'll come back and we'll delve into this a little bit more, actually.
Right.
But it's really fascinating, but there are so many questions that need answering, I guess, for this. Mm-hmm. We'll play you a little track anyway here on the Asylum on Stafford FM and dprogramradio.com. We'll be back in a few minutes with tonight's brilliant guest, Andrew Johnson, talking about 9/11, what may have happened, what could have happened, and what we think happened. It's going to be controversial, and it's going to be very, very interesting. The Asylum on Stafford FM. Good evening, then. Welcome back. 107.3 Stafford FM, The Asylum, then. It's me, Gunnar, and the Chair of Destiny, joined, as always, by my able compatriot, Scary Pete, and the D-Dog, dude himself. We should have on the line as well Andrew Johnson. We're talking tonight about controversial theories surrounding the collapse of Twin Towers on 9/11, of course. Very sensitive subject for many people. Tonight we're going to ask you to expand and to delve inside, you know, have an open mind to some of the theories that are put out there, of course. Good evening, Andrew.
Hi.
Hello. Andrew, we were talking to you before, obviously just briefly you've given us an overview about what happened on 9/11. What for you are some of the major questions that need to be answered?
Well, I think the major questions are why people didn't see what actually happened. And I think part of that is, I can answer part of that question already, because there's too much talk of theories and not enough talk of evidence. and that's what is necessary to talk about the evidence and look at the evidence, and then you don't need to theorise nearly as much. And in fact, certainly as regards to what happened to the towers, it's now known what happened. So there is actually no need to have any debates or theories about how the towers were destroyed, because it's actually known. And that's been established by a former professor of mechanical engineering, Dr. Judy Wood, and it's in her book, Where Did the Towers Go? So if you want to know what happened, you can read that book, or, you know, if you don't want to buy it, you can watch some of the video presentations, and that will show you pretty much what happened. And as I mentioned in the brief communication we had, that you can actually tie this together with other areas of research and work out, you know, again, how this is actually true and why it's true, and you can minimise the sort of theorising that's involved. I mean, you know, before the break, I outlined some of the phenomena, and that was only a very small amount, which showed that there was energy involved, some type of energy, and it was actually a form of directed energy that was used to destroy the towers. And again, if you study the evidence and don't theorise, you can find, for example, that in one of the studies that was done, there was some water which was sampled from the bottom of World Trade Center Building number 6, and it had an unusual reading on it, which was a level of tritium. Now, tritium, if you want to go and look on the internet or in a textbook, it's like a sub-form of hydrogen. It's hydrogen with some extra neutrons in the nucleus. And what it indicates is that there was some type of nuclear effect. And I would contend from that piece of evidence and others that this is why they put the nuke story out after the bombs story wasn't, you know, filling all the holes, so to speak. They needed to put another story out, which is why we have this Ed Ward and Dmitry Karlazov putting out this nuke story that was done independently, first in 2008 and then in probably 2011, I think. And I've written about this at great length. This is all in my free book, 9/11 Finding the Truth. You can download that for free. There's an audio book for free. It's all on my website. So we're talking about energy effects, and these energy effects actually had an effect on materials, and they had a selective effect on materials. And one of the effects was to create this tritium, which is a subform of hydrogen, about 50,000 times the normal level. Or is it 50 times? I might have got the figure. But basically, much, much higher than you'd expect to see in the natural environment, but not high enough for it to have been from a nuclear device, because a nuclear reactor, you know, or a nuclear bomb, that creates an awful lot of tritium, about, a million or 10 million times what would normally be found in the background. But what was found at the World Trade Center was only about 50 times the normal background. And this is in Dr. Wood's book. I apologize if I got the figures slightly wrong. So this is evidence. That's not a theory. That's what was discovered. That was, I forget the name of the guy that did the study, but you can look that up. And it's in Dr. Wood's book. And that, I point that out because that's very interesting. Sorry, carry on.
Tritium is a radioactive isotope of hydrogen, isn't it? Hydrogen. Are we talking then potentially this idea about the nuke stories? Obviously, we're not talking about a major nuke the size of Hiroshima or Nagasaki. You know, we're not talking about a huge one. Are we talking, if this was what happened, small nukes, smaller, I guess, micro nukes?
That was the term that was used, but there's actually no evidence. There's actually no evidence that they were used. You know, there's no evidence of any micro nukes existing anywhere. The only thing I ever came across when I looked at that theory was this old website by Joe Viles, who was, you know, one of these alleged military, you know, insiders sort of thing. But there's no actual evidence that I know of how these things can work, because for a nuclear device, you need critical mass if it's going to create an explosion. Of course, there's things like a neutron bomb, but that doesn't explain the evidence, and it doesn't explain the toasted cars. And as I said already, we didn't see any bright flashes, we didn't hear any enormously loud explosions, and we didn't have people being completely burned. So, but what we do know, for example, why this tritium is important is because it connects to another person that was involved in 9/11 truth research, and this was a character called Stephen E. Jones. And this Stephen E. Jones character, he invited me, along with Jim Fetzer, they both invited me to join this group called Scholars for 9/11 Truth, and that was right at the end of 2005. And they invited me to join that group, as I understand it, for two reasons. The first reason is that I work for the Open University, and I still do. I work for them part-time. And the second reason is that I was, well, I was talking about this equation of motion earlier on that I briefly mentioned about how the towers fell. I worked out that simple equation, and I started posting this on a couple of forums, and I think they were watching for people who were a bit more, perhaps a bit more, you know, had a bit more of a background in science and so forth, and they were trying to round them up into the scholars group, because I later found out that that was basically an intelligence gathering operation, and they wanted to get people into that so that they could control them and misdirect them, and that's exactly what they did, and that's all in my book. But after I found that out about what they were doing, I also found out that this Stephen E. Jones character, he was involved in another field of research back in the 80s. And would anyone like to guess what that field of research was involved with?
Oh, Andrew.
It was involved with energy research, an energy phenomenon which he termed with his friend Paul Palmer, cold fusion. And what do you get in cold fusion experiments? You get tritium. So it becomes quite clear when you look at the evidence, and there is more besides what I've just told you now, in case you think I'm just being jumping to conclusions, that tritium is very important in this sort of study of what happened to the World Trade Center and the energy effects which were seen therein. So Stephen E. Jones was really, for me at least, a key figure in this. And Stephen E. Jones, for example, worked at Los Alamos National Laboratories, and I have an audio clip of him on the Alex Jones program from 2006 stating that he worked at Los Alamos National Laboratories, and he worked for the U.S. Department of Energy back in the 80s. So why would Stephen E. Jones, do you think, start attacking Dr. Judy Wood and saying that she was gone in with these disreputable methods? And why would he start laughing publicly when Dr. Judy Wood lost her job at Clemson University? And this is, you know, this is all recorded. So the answer to me is that this guy knows that 9/11 has an energy phenomenon involved with it, and he was tasked with covering up that information. As I say, there's a lot more about this that I've written. It's all on my website. And people can find this out if they want to.
Andrew, it's a very curious reaction, though. As you say, it's almost—it's like misdirection. What the eyes see and the ears hear aren't quite the same. And for somebody to have that.
Yes, reaction, indeed.
It raises more questions.
Indeed, and this guy tried to say that thermite was used to, sort of cut through the steel girders, and then the steel girders fell down, and that's what caused the building to be destroyed. And this is ridiculous, you know, because
it's one of the earlier popular.
Well, it was indeed a theory that it wasn't really based on a lot of evidence. What they tried to do was misrepresent what happened. There are a couple of pieces of evidence which they claim supported this thermite theory. But you see, what happened was...
The angled foots being one of them.
Sorry?
The angled cuts, one of them as well, like the sort of 45...
That was one of the things, but... You're cutting out, so it's going very quiet, and then I'm speaking, I'm not hearing you, and then I'm only getting about half what you're saying.
Sorry, Andrew, I'm going to try and get a little bit closer to it for the mic for you. There was this 45-degree angle cut, wasn't it? I think was one of the arguments that's saying that that's why there was the thermite. One of the other ones was some sort of residue, I believe, as well, and
claimed,
of course, the rivers of molten metal as well, wasn't it, underneath?
This is what
well?
They've claimed. This is what's been claimed. It's basically they tried to claim that there was hot molten metal and that there was these iron microspheres discovered. There were these active thermitic materials. There were these, angle cut core columns, all kinds of stuff. But these are actually all covered in Dr. Judy Wood's book as to why those essentially have other explanations or weren't even important. I mean, one of the things that people don't seem to, not many people seem to know is what thermite actually is. Now, thermite is kind of a sort of an explanation in some ways, because what Stephen E. Jones claimed is that the steel was cut using thermite. And well, if you look at what the towers were actually made of, then you had steel columns, and there were 236 exterior columns, 47 interior ones, and they were made of steel. And what you get if you stand steel up in air for 30 years, you get rust. And what was on the outside of the towers, the exterior shiny metal, it was aluminium. So what is rust? It's iron oxide. What do you get when you mix iron oxide and aluminium together? You get thermite. So in other words, thermite is essentially what the building was made of. And that's why it seems...
I'm just looking at Scary Pete across the desk.
Yeah, well, go and check it out, you know.
Did you know, Pete? Go on, jump in, buddy.
Oh, no, aluminium oxide and iron oxide, absolutely.
See, he's often trying to create it at work.
Yeah.
I'm teasing.
Yeah, I mean, you can get it on eBay if you really want to.
So, I mean, talking then about the buildings, what is some of the evidence that doesn't add up for the building's collapse itself? I mean, we've never seen this before, have we? We've seen plenty of buildings that have been struck by large aircraft.
Well, I mean, again...
We've seen plenty of fires, but we've never seen three buildings collapse on one.
Well, it wasn't just that. There were actually all seven buildings were destroyed. Three of them were destroyed outright on the day, and they took down all the rest. And the other buildings were actually around the World Trade Center, mainly survived. They had to take one of them down. But you just go and look at the evidence. I mean, I've already said, that, for example, that 14 people survived in Stairwell B. So what happened to them? Where did the building above them go? Because they should have died.
Aren't they suffering severe health problems?
Well, that's from the dust, essentially, yeah. That appears to be from the dust, because the building was converted largely to dust. And then, of course, as you well know from looking at the pictures, I think just about everyone that's looked into this will see the carpet of dust on the ground, but it had all this paper in it. So if the building's burned up from thermite or bombs or nukes or whatever, how come that paper's still there? You know? You look at, there's a couple of vehicles which are right next to the World Trade Center, and they're not crushed. In fact, there's one picture that Dr. Wood has got in her book. There's more than one, actually, but one particular one that comes to mind is this ambulance, which has been right next to this 110-story building, in fact, next to 210-story buildings. The door's a bit bent out, but the actual ambulance isn't crushed. And there were people that right next to the building, they weren't crushed. They were covered in dust, but they weren't crushed. So this...
I mentioned...
The other thing, which I think one somebody mentioned earlier on very briefly, is this bathtub, which is like the slurry wall which the towers were constructed in. And this was to keep out the Hudson River. And there are clips from documentaries showing that they didn't want to put the earth-moving equipment into the site because they were worried about damaging the sides of the bathtub. Yet they weren't worried about these quarter-mile-high buildings coming down into it, apparently. So...
Is this bathtub, Andrew? Is this bathtub the dike that is the Twin Towers
Correct.
Were built on in order, like say, to keep the Hudson
Correct.
River out?
Yeah. And if that had been fractured slightly, the Hudson River would have come rushing in and flooded Lower Manhattan. And that didn't happen.
And I was going to say, surely you would expect that, like say, a 110-story building collapsing in its own footprint to potentially cause something that could cause that
Correct.
Fracture, maybe. We don't know how thick it is, of course. But,
yeah, I mean, it's fairly thick.
This is, we're talking about heavy building. You mentioned earlier, Andrew, about the, the seismic kind of reaction. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, because we...
Or lack of
seismic. Yeah, I mean, because if you look at the graphs, there was also, Dr. Wood pointed out, that there was a small earthquake, very small, not. I think it was on the same day as 9/11, or the day before, or something. And there was also some quarry blasts which were detected by the same detectors. So, in other words, these are essentially a way of calibrating and showing that those detectors were actually working properly on the day of 9/11. you know, because you know where these quarry blasts were and how big they should have been, etc., etc. So that actually shows you that these instruments were working properly, yet if you look at the signature from the demise of the World Trade Center, it's about the size as if they only 20 lower 20 stories hit the ground. You get a signature which is commensurate with roughly the lower 20 stories hitting the ground. So what happened to the other 90 stories? And this is also shown in the damage to the other buildings. If you look at the damage to other buildings around the World Trade Center, like there's a post office building, the World Financial Center, you'll see quite a lot of kind of bullet holes in the windows and damage, that sort of damage, up to about story number 20 on those other buildings. But if you go above that, there wasn't a lot of damage. So again, where did the top of this building go? And watch the videos again, you can see it turns to a fine powder. So the only explanation is that these buildings turn to dust.
It's crazy, isn't it?
It's the only explanation.
And they did, though. You know, I was going to say, I remember the news reports on the day, and they were kind of talking about, you know, these buildings have vaporized. They've literally disappeared. They've literally crumbled. I mean, I say, how strange is that? I've never seen that before. I don't think anybody else has ever seen
it. It's not been witnessed publicly, but they covered it up. And again, you go and study it, and then, as Dr. Wood says, you begin to wonder, how did people not see this? And you then realize what can be covered up. You know, if you talk about a UFO cover-up or whatever, then, you know, you think, oh, well, they could never cover that up. Well, if they can cover up what actually happened in the middle of a city, which I think, what, 15 million people live there? I think 8 million, and then it's 15 million when they get everyone in for working, you know, the work day or something. And it's right in the middle, and they've got film crews there and everything. Yet they covered up what happened. And people are still arguing about it today, 15 years later, you know. And people talk about theories and controversy, you know. But I've certainly known what the truth about the destruction of the buildings was since... I've known that since about 2007, so I've known that for 9 years. Yet I'm still here talking about it 9 years later, and people are still wondering about this thermite or nukes or, you know, one or two other things kicking about. That shows you that the cover-up has worked. Not only has it worked in the mainstream, but it's worked in the alternative media as well. And that's I've written more about that because of my direct experience with people about other researchers not actually quoting this evidence properly, not talking about it, misquoting it, muddling up, saying things like, oh, it was HAARP, because Judy Wood said it was HAARP. No, she didn't. She's never said it was HAARP. That was somebody else doing an impression of her that said it was HAARP. And I've written hundreds of pages about this. What it illustrates to me is how easy it is to cover something up. You know, something that's really, really obvious. It's got nothing to do with, you know, whether...
You've dropped out a little bit.
It's got nothing to do with whether a flying saucer landed or didn't, or, you know, Loch Ness Monster or something. It's nothing like that. It's much more obvious, yet they still managed to cover it up.
Get away then. If it was an energy weapon, how did it away with busting something like that? You know, how did so many people have... The wolf pulled over the right, I think.
Well, it's because, you know, you put out a number of different stories, and then you have groups like Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, which have probably a few hundred thousand dollars or $1 million of budget, to run on per year. And they're able to promulgate these stories, these false stories about bombs in the building. They go on world tours or European tours. They're supported in the UK by people like Ian Henshaw, who's based in London and runs this group called Reinvestigate 9/11. And he wrote to me two, 3 years ago and said that I was the biggest single cause of the collapse of the UK 9/11 truth movement, in case I didn't know it. And I've got that in email. And that is how you run a cover-up, you see. And then what you do is you get these fake stories going, but when it comes to push comes to shove and you start a court case, as Dr. Judy Wood did in 2007, and the 9/11 truth movement covered up the court case, and I've written about that as well. People like Annie Machon helped to keep that covered up, and still do. You get Dr. Judy Wood's court case, you put in that the energy weapon research, the energy weapon evidence, that all goes into the court. and that was done in 2007 to 2009. And then you get the Architects and Engineers Group, who pretend to start a court case with Stephen E. Jones, and they put in this document called a Request for Correction. But what was absent from that document was any mention of thermite research or molten metal, which is what they'd been talking about publicly for the 2 years prior to putting in this legal document. So this is how you know that they know that they're putting out false information, because they don't put it in the document which goes into a court, basically, because it is illegal, it is fraudulent to put fraudulent evidence into a court. They could have been prosecuted for that. So that's why they didn't put that evidence into their court document.
Andrew, you were involved with the Engineers for 9/11 Truth group, weren't you? What happened?
No, there? I was never involved with that group. I got involved with the Scholars for 9/11 Truth group, but I would argue that when that ran out of gas, because that kind of faded away, really, they needed to get another vehicle going, and that was essentially the Architects and Engineers group. That was kind of the sequel cover-up, or the sequel psyop, to the Scholars group.
So you think this is all about muddying the water?
Yeah, so precisely. It's all about creating a muddle-up and a cover-up, and it works as well.
It does. I mean, if this is what's happening, it really does, because if you, as Hitler said, if you're going to tell a lie, make it big.
Yes.
Keep saying it repeatedly over and over again, eventually people are going to buy into that lie, that idea.
Right.
But if you also create so many threads, so many theories, so many stories, I think that you probably lose 80% of the public. They kind of grey over and go, well, I'm going to go back to my normal life. I can't deal with this kind of stuff. So it kind of keeps some people entertained and engaged in a way that it draws them away from the truth. But then it also pushes a number of people away as well, doesn't it?
Yes, indeed. And I think the other thing that tends to happen in our field is that, it becomes a hobby for people. It just becomes a set of topics to discuss, And I mean, this happens at conferences as well. So it then gets lumped in with everything else as another theory or another conspiracy theory. But this is different. I mean, 9/11, certainly what happened in New York is very, very different to any other, UFO research or anything like that, because of the amount of available evidence. When a UFO lands, you might get one or two videos, or if you're lucky, and there's certainly an interesting case from South America, and that was filmed independently. It wasn't a landing, but it was a very strange object. That was in 2012, I think, which was filmed independently by two people from different angles. It's a very unusual thing, video of an object shooting spheres out. But so what I'm trying to say is that that's a very unusual case in that two people filmed it, and it's a daylight sight, and it's very clear video, very anomalous. But with 9/11, there were hundreds of videos, there were 40,000 pictures, there were tens of thousands of witnesses. So this is what lifts it in terms of research beyond just a few theories and speculation. You can actually go through all of that evidence, and this is what Dr. Judy Wood did primarily. She did this she did it from day one. I think it was sort of more or less day one she was collecting evidence, and she started to post stuff about 3 years later. She actually posted stuff on the internet for the first time in about 2004, and then she gradually built that up into writing the book, which came out in 2010. So you're looking at sort of essentially 8 or 9 years of research which went into that book, which you can now get. And so this is why it's different. You can show what happened and to the point where you can take it to court. And, she was able to establish that energy was involved, as I've already said. But then when she took the case to court, she didn't say the US government did 9/11. It's an inside job, and that's what I'm taking to court. You can't do that. That's not specific enough. You have to, have some type of law, that you're going to work against to say, well, this law was broken.
Yeah, so some law must have been
right.
broken.
Right, and then you have to essentially say, of course, who broke that law. You can't just say, oh...
I was going to say, correct me if I'm wrong, Andrew, didn't she take 24 of the companies that were involved in the NIST report to
That's
court?
Correct. There was actually 23, or you're nearly correct. So 23, Yeah, so that was attorney Jerry Leaphart got together with Dr. Wood, and they were able to build this case. And what they did was, you know, they discovered a legal avenue which they could use, and it was to do with what's called the Data Quality Act. And this was a law is a law in the US, in that if you produce a report for a government branch, and you take money for that report, and you find, you know, you as a member of the public then find that there are errors in that report, you can write to that government body, or you can write to the companies, and you can say, I found this error in your report, and you need to correct it, please. And they are obliged by law to correct it if you can prove that there's an error, a mistake. And if they don't correct it, you can sue them. And this is what Dr. Wood and Jerry Leaphart did. They sued the companies that took public money for science fraud, because they produced a report in 2005, 10,000 pages of reports, which cost $16 million of taxpayers' money. And Dr. Wood was able to prove scientifically that these reports were fraudulent because they'd not taken into account all the available evidence. And they basically ignored the seismic signature, and they described these buildings as collapsing, which scientifically speaking is incorrect. They didn't collapse, they turned to dust. And NIST eventually admitted that they didn't investigate the collapse of the buildings at all. They only investigated what happened up to the point of collapse. So that was, they admitted fraud. So that's what was taken to court. And of particular interest were two of the companies that were involved in writing these reports. And two of the companies out of the 23 were Science Applications International Corporation and Applied Research Associates. And anybody, any guesses or any knowledge as to why these companies were interesting, because, you know, what they do?
No.
They both do research into directed energy weapons.
They both do research into
both of them, yeah.
And one of them,
the other company,
one of them, Science Applications International Corporation, also does research into psychological operations. So isn't that interesting?
So PSYOPs basically.
Yeah.
So PSYOPs, basically convincing the public that something else has taken place when actually something else has taken place.
So this is what you won't hear from hardly anybody else. You won't hear this from Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. They won't tell you any of that, even though it's all true and it's all on record, you know, and you can look on their websites and find it, you know, Science Applications International Corporation and Applied Research. So you can find these things out if you really want to. These companies are founding level sponsors of the Directed Energy Professionals Society, DEPS.org. You can go and look that up. So this is all on record, you know. So how is it that these two companies happen to be helping to NIST to write these technical reports, and Dr. G. Wood uncovers these pieces of evidence that it's some type of energy effects of destroy the World Trade Center? Do you think that's a bit too much of a coincidence?
It's a bit strange, isn't it, that those two particular companies with that particular involvement, that kind of research or work, are involved in the actual NIST report itself. It's almost, dare I say, it's like having somebody on the inside to make sure that the correct information gets disseminated to the public almost.
That I couldn't really have put it better myself. And these are not theories. This is all, you know, you can go and check any of this yourself. And if you can't find any of the links or any of the information that I'm talking about, people want to know, just write to me and I'll show you where it is, you know. So this is the difference. And if people want to know what happened, they can know. You know, they can end the debate. And, you know, this is what I've been trying to do is stop all this debating, because it's a bit like debating, you know, 2 + 2 = 3. You know, do you want to debate that? What's the point in debating that? Should we debate, you know, whether today is Friday or not? You know, this is the sort of point you get to. But people, because they think it's a field of alternative knowledge research, they think it's we should debate it, and everyone should have, you know, a corner in the debate. Well, you know, yeah, there is still, I'm not saying there should be no debate about 9/11, because I don't know everything that happened, but I certainly do know what I just told you. I know that that's true. You know, I don't really know what happened at the Pentagon. I know bits and pieces. I don't really know what happened at Shanksville, you know, and so forth. But I jolly well know what happened at the World Trade Center, you know.
It's a strange story, isn't it? So let's move on then, Andrew. Let's talk a little bit about the planes that struck the buildings on that day. Do you believe that planes actually did strike the building? I know there's a number of kind of crazy ideas out there of holographic planes, you know, switched planes, planes with weapons on them, all sorts of stuff. What do you think took place?
Well, I'm not precisely sure, but it's actually relatively straightforward to prove to yourself that real planes didn't crash into the World Trade Center. Certainly, if we just stop by the Pentagon for a minute, there is no evidence of a plane crash there. You know, there are a few small pieces. I should say there's very little evidence of a plane crash there. There are a few small pieces that they picked up. But even Jamie McIntyre, who was the CNN reporter, went there and he said he couldn't see any evidence of a plane having crashed there. He later retracted that statement, but unfortunately for him, it's in the video archives now. So there's no alleged plane. There's no plane at the Pentagon. And there is one photograph of a plume.
There was even less in Shanksville,
correct,
wasn't
yeah, there? There's one photograph of a plume in the sky, and then there was allegedly this hole in the ground, and the coroner went there and said that he couldn't see any bodies. There was, you know, no evidence of a plane crash at Shanksville. So that's really ruling out two of the plane crashes right there, pretty much, really. I mean, you can go into a bit more detail. So you're left with the ones at the World Trade Center. Well, of course, everyone says, well, I saw it on TV, so must be true. But what exactly did you see? Well, I suggest that people go and revisit the so-called Michael Herzicani footage, which was the iconic footage of the Flight 175 crashing into the tower face-on. And if you look at that footage, you can see that the physics in that cannot be real. The point being, the simple point being, if that had been a real physical Boeing 757 or 767 crashing into the face of the tower, then what you would have seen is some large pieces of the aircraft would have broken off and they would have fallen into the street, such as the tail section, ailerons, parts of the wing, you know, some of the covers for the undercarriage or whatever. But if you look at that video, what you actually see is if a hole opens up in the building and the plane goes right into it. And even at that point, when the plane has disappeared and merged with the building, there isn't even any explosion. The explosion comes a split second later.
It does. It kind of passes straight into the building,
right,
doesn't it?
Right. So.
And it kind of explodes inside and out of the back,
right,
of it almost.
So as we talked about earlier, if you observe what happened to the buildings, you can begin to work out what didn't happen. And if you observe what happened to the plane in those video footage, and there are several, you can observe what couldn't have happened. That is not a real plane crash. So you then go forward from there. That plane crash cannot be real. And that's only one thing I've mentioned. There are probably 10 or 15 other things you could talk about as well. So what if it wasn't a real plane, then what was it? That's the next logical question. My answer to that is I don't know for sure. What I do know is it wasn't a real physical 767. It's not possible. So it had to be something else. You then get essentially split down into two possible explanations. The one is that what happened was this alleged video fakery, as it's been called, or CGI, so in computer-generated imagery. So they somehow managed to get all the videos and take the original footage and then insert computer-generated planes, you know, images of planes, into this footage and, you know, create this illusion of the plane crash. And indeed, this has been promulgated for a number of years now, primarily by two researchers that I probably name. There's probably others as well. Simon Schack, that's not his real name. His real name is Simon Hitton, or Hyten. And Ace Baker, or Colin Alexander Baker, as he's known. I've corresponded with both of these people. Both of them, I essentially can prove, are disingenuous and are liars. I essentially can prove that. Same with Richard Gage, the head of architects and engineers. He's a total liar, and I can prove that on my website. So then you was it video fakery? Did they make fake videos? Well, it kind of works a bit, but then you have to explain what the witnesses saw. And if you read the witness accounts, what you'll find is, and I downloaded 500 witness accounts from the New York Times website back in 2007, and I've written all this up in an article called Going in Search of Planes in New York City. And if you read those witness accounts, people definitely saw planes. Some of them did. But then you get some really weird accounts, like people, you know, the rescuing people from the buildings and stuff. And one of them says, I didn't know that planes were involved until the next day when I got back and I'd seen it on the news. So they're actually there, you know, among the debris, and they didn't see or hear any evidence of planes crashing, which is really strange.
Andrew, we'll hold you there. We'll hold you there, buddy. We'll come back after the break. All right, fella? Okay, thank you. Right then, steady. A little bit of I Made Him for you. 2 minutes to midnight here on the Asylum on Stafford FM. We'll be back with Andrew Johnson in a few minutes, talking about whether or not planes really did hit the towers on 9/11. Plenty more information on the way, of course. Stay tuned. We're here until 1 a.m. tonight. Welcome back then. The Asylum 107.3. Bring me to life, Evanescence, for you. So I've got the gents in the room, and we're joined, of course, on the line by Andrew Johnson. I swear you're mouthing something to me there, Pete, but I have no idea what it was. welcome back, Andrew.
Oh, I'm okay, you? Thanks.
Good. Andrew, you were talking just before the break about the idea of the planes, some of the evidence surrounding that. You mentioned, of course, briefly this idea that there are people out there that believe that these planes are some sort of holographic projection or something like this, or they weren't planes at all. I just want to bring you back to Richard D. Hall's research. I think he did in 2012. He's just kind of republished again, hasn't he? I think it was last week. I think he posted it on your Facebook. He went and took the actual flight path from the NIST report. He actually then put it into like a 3D model of Lower Manhattan. And then he kind of cross-referenced it with all of the video that was taken on the day. And seemingly all of the video is congruent with, you know, actually followed the flight path that did take place, you know, used on.
Yes, that's correct. And I haven't really got much to add to that because, you know, essentially he did model the paths in 3D using Google SketchUp. And I think that his research pretty much conclusively proved that what people saw and videoed was actually there in the sky. And so that you add that to the description of what they saw, and yep, it would appear that what they saw, you know, was really there. They saw it, but what they actually saw, you know, wasn't a plane. So I tend to use the term image projection. I'm pretty convinced now that there was some type of image projection technology that was used. And the, you know, the theme that we're seeing, or that I'm seeing, and hopefully other people are seeing, is that the misdirection and all these, you know, cover stories, like, for example, the official story or the bombs in the building story, and then we have this video fakery story, they are all put in place to try and keep technology covered up. And in fact, I think that that's what the UFO cover-up is, you know, largely to do with. It's not so much to do with whether they're worried about that, you know, you knowing that there are aliens or not. I mean, that's a sort of separate question. What they are worried about is people really getting a handle on the fact that this technology is real. And it is real. We certainly know that the technology that was used to destroy the World Trade Center is real. It's not a theory. It's not a debate. It's nothing like that. The technology really does exist. Now, we don't know exactly, you know, what the technology is. We know what its characteristics are. We know certain things about it. We don't know who owns it, but I think we do know who knows who owns it, and that's Science Applications International Corporation. They know who owns that technology, and probably Applied Research Associates do too. So those things are known, and that's what differentiates this from a lot of other research. And, you know, so the image projection technology has to be covered up because of what that can, what can be done with that and what they might want to do with it in future. So all this talk of video fakery, I would say, and I would argue strongly, and some of this is on my website as well, is to do with the technology being covered up. And people like Simon Schack are helping that cover up. And I'd also like to mention at this point that we have somebody on your Facebook page also helping the cover up tonight, Ken Doc 2. Big shout out for him, that cover up merchant who's called me a fraud. I have no idea who Ken Doc is. If people think that I'm a fraud, then they might want to write to me or ring me up and speak to me personally, because all the details are on my website. I doubt that Ken Doc has a website where you can ring him up and find out his email address and find out his telephone number and where he lives and what he does for a living. All that information is disclosed on my website. I give public talks about this, as you know, because I've met you twice now. But I don't think Ken Doc gives public talks. And this is kind of what baffles me, really, because we have a lot of people putting their faith and belief in anonymous internet posters that are basically just generating noise. But they're taking more seriously what these people are saying over and above what people like Dr. Judy Wood and myself are saying, even though you can find out who we are, you can find out where we live, you know what we, you can find out what we do, or if you don't, you can ask us. So this again, I'm pointing this out because it's very important for people to understand how the cover-up works and how the agents of that cover-up work, because people that get bamboozled, they don't understand the tactics, they don't understand the psychology. And this is what I've been working to kind of expose and decode. This has become really my area of sort of special interest since about 2007, when I really woke up to the fact that I was actually being used as part of the cover up at that time.
Right. Andrew, I mean, is it possible that a combination of all three of these things used? I mean, almost as if it was the IP held in, because that's going to convince a shed load of people. You know, it's going to make, plausible that these buildings then could have collapsed for people with, I guess, not a scientific background. These failed buildings collapse, and potentially an energy weapon as well. Is it possible they used all three of these things to make sure for definite these things went down?
Well, of course, you know, I can't prove that other things weren't used as well, but I'm really not interested in those things, to be honest. So let's just say that really bombs were planted in the building. I'm not interested in bombs. You know, I know how bombs work. I know what they do. They've been in existence for thousands of years. So I'm not interested in bombs. I'm not interested in nukes because I know how they work. I know what they do. I am, however, interested in energy weapon technology, which, you know, can turn buildings into dust and it can create all these unusual effects. Part and parcel of my reason for being interested in that is because I know that that technology has the potential to change the world completely, and it can make things like roads redundant, it can make cars redundant, it can make mobile phone batteries redundant, it may even make mobile phones themselves redundant. It makes all of that stuff redundant, which is why it has to be covered up. And, you know, you do get people interested in this kitchen sink approach. This is something that Dr. Wood does mention in her book, where couldn't it have been all three? Well, yes, it could. And indeed, you know, people did report the sound of explosions in the towers. But this is another common sort of stumbling block for a lot of people, in that explosive sounds doesn't necessarily mean bombs. You know, I mean, you can put an egg in your microwave oven, flick the switch, and you'll hear an explosive sound after a few seconds or a minute or two. It doesn't mean to say there's a bomb in your microwave oven. And I give that as an example because this appears to have been what was happening at the World Trade Center. Another bit of evidence that Dr. Judy Wood uncovered from the witness accounts was that there were air tanks on the back of the fire trucks that the firemen used to take into buildings, you know, to help them breathe in smoky environments and so forth, hazardous environments. And those air tanks, which are called Scott packs, were on the back of the fire trucks in the street, and they were exploding on the backs of the fire trucks, and there are several accounts of this. So how can this be, you know? And if people are talking about explosions, I'm far more interested in the fact that these tanks were just spontaneously exploding than this possible idea that there were some type of explosive devices, which I strongly doubt. I can't prove that they you know, weren't there, but I strongly doubt that there were any types of bombs in the building. Why would you bother when you've got this energy weapon technology, which worked, it worked perfectly, or near perfectly? There was a bit of a cock up with the Bankers Trust building, which we haven't talked about. And then all what you do is, after the events, you just put stories of bombs in the building into the truth movement, and that actually works as well as, if not better than, putting actual bombs in the building. You know, the stories of them is good enough, so you can easily do that. In other words, the psychological operation,
that's it,
works better than the actual practical one.
It's very easy, isn't it, too? I mean, because if we're talking about an energy weapon, it's so far removed from anything that a normal person would know. It's such a fanciful idea. It's so mystical and strange. So, you know, anyone would probably believe any other story other than that, really, and ignore good evidence, select certain parts of the evidence, I guess, you know, really easily, because the idea is so far out there. But then, like you say, you know, if that was the case, you know, firstly, you're going to have a real big issue to try and make people accept that. But then when you inject any other story, any other muddying of the waters, any other possible ideas, you can easily bury this idea very, very easily.
Oh, yeah.
Just by, and I mean, you know, muddling people's heads. You know,
the other thing I wanted to just mention, you know, that was going on during the break is the cover-up was going on during the break, because we, you know, you bury all these sorts of ideas by putting stories about chemical leaks on the news at London Airport, and then saying, oh, it wasn't terrorism. You know, okay, they're saying it wasn't terrorism, but they've got the word terrorism in the broadcast. And in fact, I think it was in the broadcast twice or three times. And this is what we're up against, you see, because...
Yeah, and the fear is still the same.
You know, and we get on the radio, you know, for a couple of hours on a Friday night or whatever, talking about these things when, you know, probably a lot of people are asleep. But the cover-up crew, both mainstream... primarily mainstream, they're getting on 24/7, on the hour, every hour, getting their rubbish out. You know, you don't have a chance. And that's, you know, you mentioned about these ideas about energy weapons being far out. That's why they're far out, because those ideas are not put on the news. That evidence is not talked about on the news, so it doesn't. People are not aware of it, and that again is part and parcel of the cover up. So, you know, if we got regular news stories about the developments in directed energy weapons, for example, then that phrase would have become more familiar to people. But, you know, we have a broadcast from 2003 from a clued-in journalist who was asking Donald Rumsfeld and one of the four-star generals at the time, General Myers. She actually asked them about directed energy weapons technology back in 2003. And they became extremely uncomfortable talking about these things, even though the directed energy weapons that this lady was referring to in this question were a different class of weapon to what I've talked about, because they were basically a derivation of laser technology or microwave technology, which is not what we're talking about with the destruction of the World Trade Center.
Now, I mean, you can go on the internet and you can have a look for these directed energy weapons. You know, people are researching them. There is work out there. People are trying to make it a reality, if it is already a reality. So, you know, exactly in the next few years, I guess in the next sort of decades or so, we're probably going to see much more of this stuff. It's strange, isn't it? Because it's really easy to bring the public along. You know, you just kind of create, I guess, an idea. Once everybody gets behind it, most people will just go, well, the TV told me, therefore it must be true. So if they announce that aliens were real tomorrow, then, you know, after a week or so, most people probably get their heads around it and accept that idea as being a... If they were talking about these things, these energy weapons and stuff like this as fact, then I guess a lot more people would take this much more readily,
yeah,
wouldn't
that's
they?
It.
And they would,
you know,
and they would listen to it. But
it's what,
this is
what people are exposed to. And going back to the plane stories a bit, you know, people saw it on the TV, so that's why they believe it, you know. And that's basically the way that it works, because they can't grasp that, you know, we're in a sort of mental control grid. And it's not only to do with 9/11. You know, the other thing that's come up just in the last couple of days is again, is the cancer cover-up, you know. and how, for example, I think there's sort of starting to be a bit of a breakthrough with that. I know we're changing tracks now, but the use of cannabis oil to treat cancer and other conditions, actually, that seems to be making a little bit of a breakthrough in the last sort of couple of years now, you know, with the work of people like Rick Simpson and a number of other people that have sort of shown that this can work. And I think the reason for that is, I was actually typing this to somebody in an email just a couple of hours ago, I think is that cancer is something that affects people's lives, you know, every day, and it affects families, and it deeply affects them. And if you have direct experience of using cannabis oil or another treatment, and there are several which are highly effective and very cheap, you then know that what that effect is, and you know it for real, because it's you know, you've had it right in front of you, you know, even in your own body, or with helping a relative or friend. And I know personally two people that have cured their own cancer using cannabis oil, and they've one of them made it themselves, you know, and they were diagnosed with advanced liver and bowel cancer, and they were given 6 weeks to live. This is a few years ago they did this, and they're alive and well today, you know, because of cannabis oil.
Now, I know there's a chap from Canada, isn't it, I think, about 10 years ago, who was kind of putting this idea out there, saying that, you know, cannabis oil can make a huge difference medically to a number of different ailments and illnesses and diseases. And it kind of rubbished for a few years, didn't it? But then it's kind of resurfaced again in the last year. I noticed you posted a video about this week, about the police officer who stands up in a court of law and basically goes, look, you know, what you've been telling us about cancer isn't true. You know, let's say there are other methods out there, but for one reason or another, people don't want methods, ideas to be out there, you know, a lot of cash over this.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and this, I think, you know, I'm hoping that this is going to be one of the areas, if we're going to see some kind of breakthrough in breaking this stranglehold that these evil people that are running the planet have on just about every walk of life, certainly in our Western organized civilizations. That's the cancer's going to be one of them, because they push the negative side of cancer so hard, you know, even more than 9/11 and terrorism. You know, it's all around you. You know, charity boxes shoved in your face pretty much every day when you go to a supermarket or any public place. You know, and it's on in radio commercials. They're putting it in adverts. You know, not only asking for money, but telling you to go and get yourself checked for some type of cancer. Or, you know, they put these scare adverts on. They've been doing that quite a lot. So they've got to be really careful now with that issue, because it's going to really, I think it's going to set people alight soon. You know, I really hope that this is going to be sort of some type of turnaround point.
It's a terrible illness, and hopefully there is a turnaround point and we can find a cure for this. Speaking of that, I have spoken to people in the past about ideas of magnetic fields, energy, directed energy, if you will. So bringing it full circle back, that, you know, these things work. Have you seen anything like that, Andrew?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is where the energy issue comes in again, because energy comes into health as well. And this was something I, you know, stumbled on. Research, I couldn't believe how old it was, you know, the research that was done by Royal Raymond Rife back in the 40s and 50s, and people want to read up on that if they're not familiar with it, because this again is to do with energy, in that Royal Raymond Rife, you know, he initially built a microscope which was even better than the optical microscopes they've got today. It's, I think, had something like 15 or 20,000 optical magnification, whereas to get that sort of magnification these days they have to use an electron microscope, and Rife was able to observe these sort of I forget what he called them now, because there's different names for these things, but these sort of pre-sub form of bacteria, they're kind of like these things which form even before bacteria grow. I can't remember the exact terminology that was used, and then he was able to subject these bacteria to energy to kill them, and he found that these bacteria had like a resonant frequency, so that what you could do is, in the same way that you can shatter a wine glass, you know, by zapping it with a certain frequency of sound of a certain amplitude and frequency, you can do the same with a living organism. If you use radio frequency energy of a certain frequency, you can actually blow the bacteria apart. And he demonstrated this repeatedly.
I'm sure I read something
about
it.
Yeah, and this is back in the 50s.
Yeah, I'm sure I read something about this recently.
Right, well, you may...
This idea that, I guess, through certain frequencies, you could stop, like, proteins connecting to certain cells or something like this, or you could force the cancer itself out of the cell.
Yeah, Rife actually discovered this BX virus, which he found was responsible for the development of some cancers, and you can still read that, apparently, in some of the medical textbooks. And it's one of these areas which is kind of put on the shelf, you know. It's not exactly covered up, but it's pretty much left on the shelf, you know. And he was able to kill this BX virus using his, BX virus, the virus is already dead according to medical, research. But he was able to kill this thing, or immobilize it, disable it. And he was able to treat cancer, you know, and doctors watched him do this. This was essentially peer-reviewed in the 50s. And, so that uses energy as well. So, again, look at Rife's technology and look what he was researching into. And again, he was, you know, eventually lambasted, and he ended up, losing most of his laboratory. He became an alcoholic, I think, towards the end of his life. And quite a sad story. And similarly, you were asking about energy and so forth in relation to sort of health and healing. And the next name that I have to mention is Wilhelm Reich, because he also looked at this life force energy, organ energy, etc. And actually, I just posted a very interesting article which was written by a chap called Leon Southgate, who wrote to me a couple of weeks ago. And he'd read Dr. Judy Wood's book, Where Did the Towers Go, very recently, only read it in the last sort of month or so. And he immediately saw in that the correspondence between some of the effects that Dr. Wood had catalogued in the destruction of the World Trade Center to some of the effects and characteristics that Wilhelm Reich himself had observed in the experiments he did in 1954 I think it was in Arizona, basically in a desert area. I think it was Arizona or Nevada. It might have been both, actually. But Reich was trying to find out why that area was a desert, or what made it a desert, and what sort of was, you know, what processes were going on to cause desertification, as it's called. And he concluded that there was this dark energy that was called Oranur, that he called Oranur. It was like a dark form of orgone energy. And guess what he thought it was to do with? He thought it was to do with radioactivity. That was involved. And he was able to do experiments on this. And there's a very, very interesting book that he wrote. It's kind of it's sort of in an unfinished form. It's called Contact with Space, and that was written in the 50s. It's a very interesting book. It's a little bit raw in places, but because he was actually put in prison, and he knew that he was very likely he was going to get arrested over his use of organ accumulators. You know, this story is well documented. You can read it up on this, but. Leon Southgate wrote this, I thought it was a really brilliant article that he'd done. It's not very long, it's only like, 1,000 words or something, or 1,200 words. It's not enormously long, like some of my other articles. And he basically lists the characteristics that Reich had sort of studied and tabulated, and compares those to the effects seen at the World Trade Center. And I'd sort of have this kicking around in the back of my mind, the connection between Reich and what happened at the World Trade Center, primarily because of something we haven't yet talked about, which is the weather on 9/11. This is another thing which is being covered up by people like Ken Dock, who's posted on that Facebook thread, and all his cronies. They don't talk about the weather on 9/11 because I bring that up because of Hurricane Erin, which people can go and check up on. And in fact, you know, you bring up Hurricane Erin, and we had somebody a few years ago when Dr. Judy Wood was on this Power Hour program with Joyce Riley, who phoned in and tried to say that this hurricane didn't exist. And it was ridiculous, because you can go into the hurricane archives and see that this really did exist, and it really did move up from Bermuda, where it did a bit of damage on the 7th of September. It travelled in a straight line for 4 days towards New York City, and it was closest to New York City, this Hurricane Erin. It was a Category 3 storm, and it was closest to New York City at 8 o'clock in the morning, just as the events in New York were unfolding, and then it made a right-hand turn out towards Newfoundland on September the 12th. So what was it doing there? What was this storm system doing there? Well, you know, we think we have a partial answer to that at least. But other people don't talk about this. Annie Machon won't talk about it. Richard Gage won't talk about it. Dane Wigginton won't talk about it. Andy Thomas won't talk about it. Ian Crane won't talk about it. None of these people will talk about it. And I think this is to do with the fact it's to do with energy, and they're covering up the use of this energy technology. And why I went from that to Reich is that Wilhelm Reich was also doing research into weather effects. He was doing that for several years in the early to mid-50s at his ranch called Organon, which I think is in Maine. I think it's in Maine. I hope I've got that right. And he was doing experiments with what are called cloud busters. And if anybody's, I don't know how much people have heard about that.
Not a lot.
Well,
actually,
I can mention something that you will have heard of, because
I just wanted to bring you back.
I'll just mention briefly. I'm just wondering if we're coming up to a break.
No, go on, sorry, Andrew.
Yeah, I think there's just a slight lag on the Skype.
We've got about 10 minutes left.
Why you might have heard of that potentially, you might not realise you have heard of it, but Wilhelm Reich had a son called Peter Reich. And in the 70s, he published a book called The Book of Dreams, which is sort of like a diary, you know, a chronicle. It's not really a scientific book or anything. And he talks about working with his father on the Cloudbusters. And this book's called The Book of Dreams. And it was actually republished last year. And you can get this relatively cheaply now. And there's PDFs that you can download if you look for them. But Peter wrote this book called The Book of Dreams. And that book was read in the 80s by a certain lady called Kate Bush, and she used that as the theme for her song Cloud Busting, and you can hear the lyrics refer to the Organon Ranch, which is what Peter Reich writes about. So that's where that song comes from. So as I say, these are not theories, you know. I mean, how this all fits together, you know, some of that is kind of theoretical. But the evidence that I've talked about, the hurricane was there, it was real, the towers turned to dust, the energy effects were seen, observed in the evidence, and so forth. That's all real.
So, Andrew, are we talking about something like HAARP? What kind of directed energy technology could we be talking about? Where would it come from? How would it operate?
Well, we don't know where it came from exactly. A lot of people want to jump to the HAARP answer because, again, that's one of these things that's become a meme. It's popularized a lot, by people talking about it a lot. You get scalar weapons, that's another term that's thrown around. But basically, what's in Dr. Wood's book, the term that you'll find in there to describe the sort of this thing collectively is magneto-gravitic electronuclear interactions. I might have got the order of that slightly wrongly. But what we're basically talking about...
Well, it was a hell of a sentence.
Right. It's interaction between magnetism, electricity, gravity, and nuclear effects. And that, as I said, we've essentially covered that very quickly tonight in the time that we've had. But all of that is in the evidence. We haven't talked about the gravity yet, really, but that is also in the evidence. And Reich also talked about effects on gravity with his orgone energy, or how orgone energy was interrelated with gravity. And this is another big secret, how gravity works. I mentioned that earlier on in the program. You know, if we could have an anti-gravity technology where, we could levitate things with some type of technology, that would transform the world completely. The world we live in we wouldn't have roads, we wouldn't have this horrible motorway congestion and this horrible chaos that we have, and 3,000 people being killed a year on the roads. You know, it's a horrible rubbish system. yet people are made to think it's good when they have all these wonderful MPVs that do, you know, 50 or 60 to the gallon. It's just rubbish, you know. I mean, you look at what these flying saucers can do, you know. You look at that. You look at that they can sort of zip off at 0 to 8,000 miles an hour in 1 second, which is what's been observed time and time again. That's what we should have. That's what we should all have, you know. But evil people have prevented us from having this technology, and instead what they've done is they've turned it into a weapon. They've turned it into a weapon system, folks. That's not a theory. That is the truth, right? And we know some of the culprits who are involved in the cover-up, and some of them are on Facebook tonight, folks. That's how bad it is, right?
Either knowingly or unknowingly.
Knowingly, some of them, that you can prove that they know. We can certainly prove that Stephen E. Jones knows. That's beyond any shadow of a doubt. And, you know, he knows that. He knows that I'm going round and talking about him, you know, because, there's another story I could tell you, but it's all on my website anyway. But going back to the what is the technology? Well, we're talking about field effects. We're talking about the interaction between magnetic fields and electric fields. I mentioned that because we go back to the Hurricane Erin storm. What's associated with the storm system? Electricity. The thunderstorm has electricity associated with it. Dr. Judy's book catalogues some of the weather data from the New York airports, JFK, LaGuardia and Newark. Those airports all reported dry thunder on 9/11. So that means that dry thunder is where you can hear the thunderclap, but the thunderstorm is way off in the distance and there's no rain, you know, that nearby. But if you have a thunderclap, it means there was an electrical discharge, which means that the electrical field associated with the storm reached to New York City and to Washington, D.C. as well. So that's on record. So we have the electrical effects.
So do you think this is a byproduct then, Andrew?
I think that the storm was actually maneuvered there. That's one of the other big cover-ups. Yeah, so I think...
We talked about weaponizing.
I think that they've got some technology, probably in space, though not necessarily. Dr. Wood doesn't say this. This is my sort of way of speaking about it. She won't speculate where the weapon is, but I think they've got some type of spaceborne technology. Mm. They used it to steer the storm, I would say, and then that storm has an associated electric field with it. That's not open to question. That's, you know, recorded scientific fact. And then somehow they were able to use that and change the Earth's magnetic field, because the other part of the research that we haven't discussed is that the changes in the Earth's magnetic field, which were documented in the Alaskan magnetometers, which that's all on Dr. Wood's website and in the book. So we saw changes in the Earth's magnetic field. We already talked earlier about the tritium, which is a result of a nuclear effect. So we've got the nuclear effect, we've got the magnetic effect, we've got the electrical effect, and then we've got the gravity effect, which is whereby, for example, witnesses were levitated. David Hansher, photographer of the New York Daily News, he gives us this account of he was near the building when it turned to dust and he was lifted up and carried a block. Another guy, I don't know his name, but I've got a video, very short video clip of him saying that he was lifted off the ground physically and thrown against the wall. We have another witness that as the building was coming apart, he dove under an ambulance. And when he got up, you know, thinking he was going to die, he got up a couple of minutes later and the ambulance had gone, you know. In fact, no, he says an ESU truck. It's not an ambulance. I think it says an ESU truck, which is, I think, similar to an ambulance. So that was the effects on gravity. And then, of course, the weight of the buildings disappearing. Well, that was an effect of gravity, too. So this is how we know the certain effects, you know, of this technology. We know that there's a technology which affects gravity. That was seen. We know that they can use it to influence the magnetic field. That was measured, and so was the electrical effects of the storm. So were the electrical effects of the storm. So all that's on record, you know. And this is basically the biggest cover-up. It's a very successful cover-up, stretching right into Facebook posts tonight. That's how quick on their feet they are, So that's you know, really a very sort of rapid run through at breakneck speed, some of the stuff that I've been coming across primarily since 2007.
Very interesting stuff, Andrew, as well. We've pretty much run out of time, so that is a good place to hold you. Quickly, you're talking next year, aren't you, at the UFO Truth Conference at Holmfirth again?
I have been asked to speak there, yes, and I will also be at the one in April, which is in Watford. They've asked me to speak there as well, very kindly. And, yeah, I'm going to be at Swansea in January for the UFO group there. And I'll probably be at New Horizons again in March or April sometime. That hasn't been decided. But anybody wants me to give a talk to their group or anything, people want to talk to me on Skype, I'm fairly easy to get hold of. So send me a message and we can sort something out.
Wicked. And what's you talking to me about, Andrew? Is it about all of this research?
I haven't decided exactly what I'm going to talk about at the UFO Truth Conferences yet. I'm probably going to talk about some of the cover-up elements and what I've learned about that, because that's going on in ufology as well, to some extent. And Swansea, on the 31st of January, I'm going to talk about the Star Child Skull, Lloyd Pye's research, essentially.
Oh, right. Yeah, the Star Child Skull was at the last UFO Truth Conference.
Well, I took the replicas. So I've got one of the replicas. Yeah, they had a few replicas made a couple of years ago, and I've got one of those. So, yeah, I took that to the conference, yeah.
Interesting. Andrew, thanks very much for speaking to us tonight. We'll have to get you on in the future. Delve into some more of your research as well, particularly things like anti-gravity. I'd love to talk to you about that, actually.
Great. Well, thanks for inviting me.
Great stuff. Andrew, thanks very much for speaking to us tonight. Take it easy, and I'll speak to you very soon.
Okay, thanks a lot then.
Take care. Bye.
Wicked. Andrew Johnson there this evening then. A lovely conversation. Very far out. Very difficult for, let's say, a lot of people, perhaps, some of the theories that are out there. It's interesting because I've never really put it together one-on-one with the idea, I guess, about 9/11. But we've spoke many times, Darren, before on this show about ideas of energy weapons.
Yes, we have.
Weather weapons, this sort of stuff. Could it be possible that they use this on 9/11, buddy, do you think?
That's all I'll say. There is evidence either that we support that. But I'm not sure. I'll be honest, it's one of those subjects that it's like the conspiracy is covering the conspiracy is covering the conspiracy.
Like a dream within a dream, within a dream. But that's what I mean, is if you were to pull off one of these things, and bear in mind, you know, we've mentioned PNAC before on this show, you know, Project for New American Century, this idea of creating one world government. If you had this technology, it would be so easy to flummox the world, especially when they had no concept of it as well.
Yeah, of course,
it's almost like, let's say, travelling back in time, landing in an aircraft, almost like cargo cults, you know, after the Second World War. I guess this idea, you landed somewhere like in the Philippines or something, or somewhere in some island near Japan. You know, and the indigenous peoples, 20 years later, when you go back, have built effigies of planes and stuff like
That's
this because
great,
they've got
yeah.
no concept. So if they did have this technology, then it'd be surely very easy to pull the wool over the people's eyes.
I believe so, but at the end of the day, planes did actually crash into the tower. Whether they were drones or whether they were commercial airliners, I don't know. But something definitely hit those towers. It wasn't just some kind of superimposed image that was shoved on afterwards. I mean, me and Pete have been looking through God knows how much footage while the interview has been going on. And you can actually see that it is a physical entity that actually does hit the bullet of the brain.
I agree with that. I'm kind of feeling, I wonder if all three might have happened anyway. But we've run out of time, gents.
Very possible.
Definitely fascinating stuff. We'll have to find out more. The interesting thing is that that we don't take everything that we're told for red. You know, we actually look into it, we research it. And I think that, as Andrew would probably agree, is that this story is probably in many ways just beginning.
Yeah.
You know, it's certainly not over, for sure. Peace out, be lucky. Have a fabulous week, whatever you do. We'll be back same time next week, of course, with another insane asylum. With us bunch of crazy fools, that's what we do, of course. Look for the trees, whilst having a laugh, a giggle, and a joke. Take it easy, peace out, be lucky. Have a fabulous week. Easy, a little bit of the Who to play you out. Pete, don't choke yet, my friend. Oh, I shouldn't have said that. He's actually doing it.
He is choking.
Okay, take it easy. We'll be back, like I say, next week. Brilliant interview for you lined up next week as well. Nick Cernicek talking about inventing the future, I believe it is, if I remember correctly. I could tell you for sure, but my battery's run out, so I can't.
We're back next week, 10 to 1. This is Gunnar signing out. Peace out.